So let us talk about this hour's subject matter. Say the word school, and a number of other words quickly come to mind. Among them should be the word grades. Those are the benchmarks that measure how well a student is doing in school. Do they, though? I mean, do grades actually measure mastery of subject? Because they include a lot more than test scores. Our guest this hour challenges the grading orthodoxy and offers a very stark alternative. Joe Feldman is the author of Grading for Equity, what it is, why it matters, and how it can transform schools and classrooms. Joe Feldman has worked as a teacher, principal, and district administrator. He was the founding principal for a charter school in Washington, D.C., and the director of charter schools for the New York City Department of Education, among other jobs. Right now, he's the CEO for Crescendo Education Group, which consults with schools and districts to improve education and grading. Joe Feldman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So when we talk about grading for equity, what kind of equity are we talking about here?
Well, as you said, grades are something that we always think about when we think about schools. And some of the most important decisions that we make about students, decisions that affect the trajectory of their lives, are based on grades that they get. So, you know, we decide whether students graduate or not, or whether they're promoted to the next grade, or whether they can participate in extracurriculars, or get scholarships, or get accepted to college, and even car insurance rates can be affected by grades. So there are major decisions that we base about grades, and yet we don't really spend a lot of time thinking about, are we grading in ways that reflect what students know? And so after working for 20 years as a teacher, principal, and district administrator, I really wanted to figure out, are we using grading that shows what students know, and found that oftentimes teachers are using practices that don't tell us what students know. They're using practices that aren't mathematically sound, that are highly subjective, and that often can demotivate students. And really, it's not their fault. Teachers aren't given any training in how to grade and no support in how to grade. So I thought it was really worth exposing and talking about and empowering people to fix.
The example you used to start the book, a couple of three middle school math classes, is fascinating. I mean, how could three classes with the same curriculum, same tests, very similar student body composition, come up with such different grades?
That's right. So that was actually what started my journey along this. I was a district administrator in California and saw that in a school there were teachers that were next to each other in classrooms, and they were all teaching Algebra 1. And one teacher had a failure rate of 10%, which meaning 10% of their kids were failing a class. And next door, the same algebra class, same textbook, same training, the students were similar. The teacher had 40% of their kids failing the class. And when I looked, it looked like what was different in those classrooms were the way that the teachers were grading. So one teacher might take off points for late work, and another one might do extra credit, and another one might allow students to retake tests. And so what happened is that the grades would reflect not so much what students know, but the way that their teachers graded them.
So when Mallory, the principal in this case, took it up with the three teachers, how'd that go?
Well, grading I like to call the teacher's last island of autonomy. So when there are so many expectations placed on teachers nowadays, grading is the one area that they really can control and bring all their professional judgment. And so when Mallory started to question all of those things, teachers got often very defensive, and that's not unusual in schools. It's very difficult to broach the conversation because grading really is everything that a teacher does every day in a classroom. For everything they ask a student to do, they have to decide, am I going to grade it or not? And so when you start to ask questions about that, it can generate a lot of reactions, strong reactions from teachers.
So when you were a principal yourself, how much leeway did you like to provide teachers for what they would and would not give grades on?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good balance to give teachers the authority to make decisions, but when we do that, we actually have to give them a lot of education around grading, and teachers don't get that. So I found now in my work, when we work with teachers, they're initially skeptical, and then they are so appreciative of getting a lot more information around the history of grading and why are we grading in this way of all possible universes of grading. And once they start to see the benefits of more equitable practices, they start to adopt those. And then you generate this consensus among teachers, like, oh, of course, this is how we all want to do it. And you get a lot more consistency than if me as a principal said, hey, everybody, we're going to do X. teachers don't like that very much.
No, I can imagine why. I do want to learn more about the history, but I'll hold that off for just a bit. I want to ask a question I'll probably ask again later once we've learned more, which is, how do you provide a relatively uniform grading setup without snuffing a teacher's creative spark?
Right. So it goes to thinking about what is the purpose of grades and what are some approaches that we think are better. So one example is that there's a lot of subjectivity that goes into grading. And when that subjectivity is a real problem is when it goes into the biases that teachers have. And there's something called an implicit bias, which is when a person makes particular judgments about people or makes assumptions about people based on their appearance or something about their behavior, and they're not even aware that they're making it. And so what we need to do is figure out when that happens in our grading and do things to prevent those biases from operating. So an example is teachers often grade students on participation, and they'll give them points for raising their hand or contributing to a discussion or by taking notes or things like that. And the problem is that when teachers reward students for those kinds of behaviors, what teachers are really doing is that they're projecting what participation looks like for them, the teacher, at who they were as a student and what they think learning looks like, and then rewarding students if they seem to show those same characteristics. When in fact, a student who doesn't raise their hand may be learning a lot more than the student who does, and the student who isn't taking notes as vigorously may be learning just as much, or the student who looks like they're not paying attention may be paying a lot of attention. And so if we're aware of those things and what those biases are, we want to control those and get those out of our grades.
All right, and very quickly, because we have to go to a break, but it sounds like we're still including citizenship then very much in our grading process, not just mastery of subject.
That's right, and that's what makes grades difficult to understand. When I'm combining so many different things together, it's hard to know what it means.
All right, much more to talk about with Joe Feldman. His book is called Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. You're more than welcome to join this conversation on The Exchange by phone and email, 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Joe Feldman and your questions and comments in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about grades in school and how the system can be changed and, in the opinion of our author, should be changed. Joe Feldman has written a book called Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. What he proposes is really stripping it right down to the basic essence of, does the student have mastery of the subject matter? You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we lay out Joe's vision. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So as we're talking about, I mean, I even remember in school a portion of the grade being referred to as citizenship. So grades really do communicate a lot of different things right up to the present day.
That's right, and that's part of the problem. So let's look at two students. They're sitting next to each other in a class, and one of them knows the content very well at maybe the highest level, and, you know, slumps down in their seat and doesn't contribute so much and is maybe a little shyer, and maybe they even come late to class a couple times a week. And then the student next to that student gets a B because they, you know, aren't behaving in the right way or they're not showing certain citizenship. And then you have the student next to them who's just an angel and follows all the rules and comes to class on time and raises their hand, and their content knowledge is pretty weak. Maybe it's at a C level. But they also get a B because of their citizenship. So you have two students sitting next to each other with the same grade. They both got a B, but they're so different from each other. And so it really is very confusing about what a grade means. The student who doesn't know the content very well but has followed all the rules gets the message that they're fine. And then they go to the next grade level in the next course, and they just get crushed because they're not prepared for it. And the student didn't have any idea, the parents didn't have any idea, the school didn't have any idea. And so you start to create these big, big problems for kids when you combine all the information together.
But I'm sure some of the thinking here is that you at least provide some leverage for the teacher with the students, some greater ability to provide uniformity and discipline in the class, or not discipline, but at least some a sense of order in the class by making sure that if a student knows that if they cause problems for the learning process of the other students, that they will get penalized for it.
That's right, and that comes up a lot where teachers say, well, you know, if I don't do those things, if I don't give students points for acting in ways that they need to act, it's going to make it much more difficult for the classroom to function. And I think there's two ways to think about that. The first is that this really goes back to how we understand motivation. And 100 years ago, Skinner was very interested in behaviorism, and this is
the B.F. Skinner
of the rats, and you know, you teach the rats to pull a lever, and then they get food. And so we believed 100 years ago that we would motivate people extrinsically from, you know, outside them, and that was the most powerful way to influence behavior. And so that became embedded in the way that we grade. The problem is that now we know that extrinsic motivation is a very, very poor motivator for people, particularly when it comes to learning. And we want to motivate people intrinsically. And so when we reward students with points, we're essentially treating them like rats. Do something that I ask, and I'll give you points. And it, first of all, doesn't stick. Students won't actually internalize those behaviors. And secondly, it teaches students to be focused on the points rather than learning. And I know we bemoan students who are always, you know, point grubbing and arguing over points, and we've taught them to do that. And what we found is when teachers start to give feedback in other ways besides the grade, so we have conversations with them, and we call their parents if we need to, and we use other strategies and don't include it in the grade, we find that students start to internalize their behaviors and act in better ways in the classroom.
All right, but if you're trying to get to a point where the grades aren't you're not getting penalized, for example, for being a little more mouthy in class or not participating in class on the other end of the spectrum, I can imagine a few people thinking this is sort of like the everybody gets a trophy way of thinking. Is it that?
No, and in fact, what happens is that when we've done this with schools and teachers, the percent of A's actually goes down. Because what's been happening is that there's a lot of grade inflation that's happening because students are acting in ways that the teacher wants, and students are getting rewarded for compliance and bringing in extra credit and, you know, raising their hand when they're supposed to, but they're not necessarily showing higher learning. And so grades are actually getting inflated from that. And at the same time, students who had been penalized before because they have different learning styles or because the teacher sort of misunderstood how they were acting are getting fewer D's and F's. So we're seeing, at the same time, ironically, both less grade inflation and less grade deflation.
That was the next question, whether you're seeing fewer F's as well as fewer A's, and the answer is yes.
Yeah, that's right. And interestingly, it's not, it does not cut across all student populations equally. So what we're finding is that African-American and Latino and poor students who qualify for free or reduced lunch, who come from lower-income families, they're having a greater decrease in D's and F's when you do this. And the predominantly white and higher-income students from higher-income families, are the ones getting a higher percent of decrease of A's. So in other words, we're sort of discovering that the century-old system of grading was rewarding students with privilege and punishing those without, and perpetuating the achievement gap without us even knowing it.
Joe Feldman is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Has worked as a teacher, principal, and district administrator. He's with Crescendo Education Group now as the CEO. He's written a book called Grading for Equity, Why It Is, What It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. So let's get into that history lesson. The way we've been grading dates back to when, Joe?
Well, the idea of an A through F system started in the Industrial Revolution. We had this mass migration to cities, and we needed to find a way to educate children, and we needed to really find a way to sort them. We were all about sorting back in the turn of the century. And so grades became a really easy way to sort. We knew we could say A, B, C, D, F. We, in the past, in the one-room schoolhouses, we would give narrative grades. Teachers would give lots of description and written or verbal feedback. And so we started to use the A through F system. And once we started to think about schools as sorting, we started to have ideas about, well, there were certain kids who needed to have Fs and certain kids who needed to have As, and it was just a way that we could easily identify them. And so the way that persisted today is sometimes we think, well, you know, a rigorous course means that there are kids who fail it, or not every kid can be successful because some kids just get Fs. And we've gone beyond that in the education world. We actually think that all kids can graduate from high school. And so we've got two contradictory ideas going on. And so we can't grade in the same way that we did 100 years ago when we were all about trying to identify kids quickly and sort them.
So are you saying we're still using the infamous bell curve, that there's always a distribution that includes some A's, some B's, some C's, some D's, and some F's? There's no situation where you wouldn't have any A's or any F's?
Well, that's right. That we still are using the bell curve, and that sticks in the mind of a lot of teachers. You'll even hear teachers say things like, well, my class is a real rigorous class because there are kids who fail and very few kids get A's. And the problem with that is when we have standards in schools and we expect students to meet all the standards, it shouldn't matter how many A's, B's, C's, D's, and F's there are, because we actually don't want to have schools be sorting. It's almost like just because we have a bullseye, we don't have the size of the bullseye shrink when more people hit it.
So you mentioned that the idea of sorting rose from the movement of people into cities with the Industrial Revolution. So this is a very different society today. When you look at the needs of today's society, what more should a grade account for, or what less should a grade account for?
That's right. And extrinsic motivation was also another big idea that was happening at the time. And we also had beliefs about growth and fixed mindsets. You may have heard about this idea that actually we want people to think of themselves as being able to improve, and people aren't just, you're born with a certain intelligence and that's all you'll ever be. And so as we think about motivating students, we don't want them to have this fixed idea, and so that we can't grade with this fixed idea ever. We have to have ways for students to show that they're growing over time. So one more equitable practice is the idea of retakes. So normally, you study, you take a quiz or test, and then you move on to the next unit. And if we believe that students can continue learning, if we believe in a growth mindset, then we actually want to give students a second chance to take a test. In the real world, there are second chances to take tests all the time. Driver's license, you can take it an unlimited number of times. The bar exam,
the
medical
big one, yeah.
Boards. I mean, all of these tests in the adult professional world to show competence, we allow multiple chances. And so we should do the same thing for kids.
Joe Feldman, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, educator, teacher, principal, district administrator. He has written a book called Grading for Equity, what it is, why it matters, and how it can transform schools and classrooms. We're talking about essentially ripping up the old A through F system in favor of something else, and we'll get into that in the minutes ahead. You can join in with your thoughts on the process. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Traditional grading stifles risk-taking, you're right, Joe. How?
Well, when we do things like give students points or not for homework. So, a teacher will assign a homework assignment and say, okay, you've got to do these questions and come back and we're going to correct it and you'll get a certain number of points for the number of correct answers. So we're telling students, right now you can't make mistakes, because if you make a mistake on this homework, you're going to lose points and that will be incorporated into your grade. But at the same time, there has to be a safe place for students to practice. And homework is really supposed to be that place. And so we're giving students, again, contradictory messages. We're saying, don't make mistakes, because if you make mistakes, you'll get punished. And at the same time, well, it's good to make mistakes, and the homework's a good place to do it. And you have to make mistakes in order to learn. So we're stifling kids from being able to take risks, because every time they make a mistake, we're subtracting points for that.
So to avoid risk, what do you see students doing?
Well, student who doesn't do homework at all because they'd rather not hand it in than to get a bunch of red marks on it, for example. Or when there's a test and a student feels like, oh, I wasn't able to prepare the way I would, or I'm worried about what I'll get on it, they just won't show for the exam. And that's not a really rational response, we know that. But, for a teenager or a middle school kid, like, that might be the most sort of face-saving and psychologically safe way to resolve the problem. And so once we start changing the way that we grade, which is saying, okay, you can get second chances, take this exam, and if you don't do so well, you can continue learning and try again, you start to really get kids to feel much less pressure. We find that it lowers the stress in classrooms, and kids actually perform better because they're not as stressed, because they know that the retake's coming.
So that's the central feature of incentivizing risk-taking, let them know that they'll have a chance to take the risk again?
That's right. That's right. That it's not a one shot and you either make it or you don't. And we're finding that Teachers are worried about that because they think that, oh, you know, if they know there's a retake, they won't take the first test seriously. But it actually doesn't happen that way. What happens is that students perform better the first time because they feel much less stress, and they know that they're going to get a second chance anyway. And, you know, no kid wants to take a test two times if they don't have to.
Right. But school structure aside, I mean, the kids are, you know, they're human kids. Nobody likes to be wrong a lot. So, I mean, when you get into a situation where they're providing a bunch of wrong answers, they are going to get frustrated, aren't they?
Well, but the good thing is that they don't have to stay with those. They don't have to live with those wrong answers. The way the system is right now is that if you don't do well on a test, that grade that you get sticks with you, and it gets averaged into your performance. So even if at the beginning of a unit you don't know the material very well and you just do a terrible job on the first quiz, but by the end you know it perfectly, that low performance on that first quiz is going to weigh you down. And that's another thing that we talk about in equitable grading. So the way it works now is you have the low performance at the beginning and the high performance at the end, and you average over time. So the kid who had an F at the beginning and knows the content at the end and got an A will end up getting a C, which actually is not accurate. The student is at an A level, and they learned. They learned from their mistakes. They learned over the course of the term. So you're punishing the student for their early failures.
So how, in essence, turn over the steering wheel, the switch from extrinsic motivation coming from the teacher and outside forces to intrinsic motivation? This could be, it sounds like, a lengthy process.
Well, it is, unfortunately, because we've actually taught them to be extrinsically motivated. When I have a first grader at home, and that I volunteered in the class a couple of weeks ago. And they were doing a unit on, you know, something with science, and the kids were totally into it. And no kid asked, how many points do I get? It's only about the fourth grade, fifth grade level, that teachers start introducing points. So we take students who are intrinsically motivated to learn, and we teach them that school is really about extrinsic motivation. And so if we've taught them to be extrinsically motivated, we can remind them and teach them how to be intrinsically motivated. And it does take a little while when you have teenagers, but teachers do it, and they find that students start pursuing learning and wanting to do better in their classes, not because they're getting a lot of points, but because they enjoy feeling successful.
Joe Feldman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Grading for Equity. So now we get into things like when we talk about intrinsic motivation, getting into cultural differences, helping the teachers understand their students a little better, and for example, not to downgrade behaviors that they are not familiar with.
That's right. And that is something that teachers are aware that they have these biases. I think, fortunately, there's been a lot of conversations in schools about how there's a lot of cultural diversity in our classrooms. And teachers do a lot to counteract that and to address that. You know, there's a lot of very interesting curriculum that teachers are using, and they're thinking about learning styles. But there hasn't been any conversation about how grading needs to change as well. And so teachers are finding that when they start allowing for students to act in different ways and not having it influence the grade, they could still get consequences. And we're not saying that the classroom should just be some free-for-all. There can still be rules and expectations and all that. But when the student's behavior is not included in the grade, it starts to give the student a sense of fairness that they often don't feel.
That was an important addition. So there are still consequences, but they are consequences outside of the grading system?
That's right. So there's a whole array of consequences that teachers have at their disposal that I think they don't always realize that they can use, and they fall back on the grade because it feels like the most powerful place, right? I can always hold that grade over the kid's head. But it may not be a very effective way, and it certainly isn't an equitable way. And so there's all kinds of consequences that schools have around whether it be sort of along the behavior, behavior consequences like detentions and other kinds of feedback. But what we find is that by grading more fairly, teachers actually develop much stronger relationships with their students. Students feel like they're treated fairly. They start to trust their teachers a lot more. And the behavior problems go down simply because the student knows that the teacher is treating them fairly.
So we have an email here from, there's only an email address. I'll just say R in Ashland. Says, great discussion. How do you achieve equity in subjective areas such as fine arts or English composition?
That's a great question. So that comes up all the time. One of the ways that we talk to teachers is to come up with something called rubrics. And a rubric is essentially a description of the expectations that are normally in a teacher's head. So if I want students to write a particular kind of essay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to describe all the different things that make it a high-quality essay. And I'll even explain to students what is sort of close to high quality and then what is farther away from high quality. And I'll give descriptions so that I'm very transparent with students about what I'm expecting. And now that I've made what makes a good essay transparent and everybody has the same information, it reduces subjectivity because now a student could grade their essay just like I could. You can do the same thing with a dance performance, even something that is around a lot of creative expression. Teachers can create rubrics that talk about some of the technique and some of those creative elements that allow students to recognize, oh, this is what makes for an A. Because we actually don't want to hide that from students. If we hide the path to success, it's going to be much more difficult for them to go down that path.
And a couple seconds to a break here, Joe. Jamie in Medford wants to know what you think of a pass, no pass system, just a simple positive negative.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of virtues to that, and I actually don't mind so much that there's an A through F system. I think that's here to stay, and I think there's very little way that we can get around some of the uses of an A through F. I'm suggesting that we want to make the grades reflect only what students know, and if we do that, we're going to get a lot more accurate information.
All right, much more to discuss with Joe Feldman about his book, Grading for Equity, what it is, why it matters, and how it can transform schools and classrooms. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Joe Feldman and your comments and questions in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are getting an education on education in this hour with Joe Feldman, who is the CEO for Crescendo Education Group, consulting with schools and districts to improve education and grading. His book is called Grading for Equity, what it is, why it matters, and how it can transform schools and classrooms. And one of the major points is to grade students on their mastery of the subject matter and not much else. And we'll get into ideas for new systems in a moment. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a listener call. I want to bring in Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joe Feldman.
Yes, good morning. In my teaching experience in a junior college back in the 1970s, I finally went to a system like the scouting movement uses with merit badges of checking off, especially in a class that I taught on basic electronics, using workbooks and lab manuals. And the students just had to do the experiments, and the grading started on the first day of the class, and the students were basically grading themselves. And one of the things that I used to do is have the students grade themselves, and then I'd grade them, and we'd have a conference, individual conference. And so that was another way I handled it. And in a class on creativity, where I realized that I was not teaching creativity, but just showing people what it was that were in the class, that I had to eliminate the grades altogether. And the way that I did that was I either gave everybody a pass, or which was an A, or a fail, which was take it over again. But I'm very much impressed with the simplicity of the grading system and the complexity of the learning process itself. There is quite a contrast between the two. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that, Carter. Thoughts, Joe?
Yeah. I mean, some of the things that Carter's talking about are things that I think can still be useful today, particularly having students be able to self-assess, to grade themselves. Not that we would put their grade in the grade book, but having students be more aware of where they are relative to where they need to be. This goes to the rubrics that I was talking about earlier. One thing that also comes up is that, you know, there are a lot of structural inequities that I think a lot of teachers aren't even aware of, again, because they haven't received any training in this. So we're often rewarding or punishing students for things outside their control. So an example is homework. So teachers assign homework, and they give them points for bringing it back, for giving it a shot or completing it. And what we often fail to remember is that homework is a lot easier for students if they have two parents at home and in the evening, and maybe they're both college-educated, and maybe it's a well-lit area, and the student doesn't have a job after school or after school sports, and they're able to complete the homework, whereas a student who has maybe a single parent who's working in the evening and the student is taking care of younger siblings and it's a smaller apartment and a lot noisier and not well lit and English may not be their first language and there's no one who can really help them, they're going to have a much harder time completing homework. And so we've inadvertently built in some structural inequities where certain kids, certain types of kids are able to get higher grades on homework than others for things outside their control. And so that's another area where we talk about we actually don't want to include homework in the grade. We want kids to do it, and we want to give them feedback. But if we include their performance on homework, we're replicating the disparities that we see in the world.
All right, so let's move on and talk about what you do envision for the future and hope people will go to. And you said the three pillars of equitable grading are accurate. The system is accurate, it is bias-resistant, and it is motivational. So let's break down accuracy further. Would you ditch the 0 to 100 scale?
The problem with the 0 to 100 scale is it's disproportionately oriented toward failure. So I won't go into all the mathematics now, but a very stark way of understanding it is that in most school grading systems, 0 to 60 is the F range, and passing from C to above is from 70 to 100. So we're using a grading system where we have almost two-thirds of it that are used to describe student failure and about a third of it used to describe student success. So on its face, we seem to be sending a very weird message about what we're concerned with in schools. And but aside from that, having so many different levels of failure and levels of success are really meaningless. So if I said, well, tell me the difference between a student who's at an 84 and a student who's at an 85, there's no way to describe that student. And the 0 to 100 scale is a vestige of the Industrial Revolution's interest with percentages and quantifying everything. And a much better system is to use one that has fewer gradations. So a 0 to 4, which actually is the GPA scale, you don't really need more than those four designations or five designations, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and maybe pluses and minuses. But it makes it much simpler and much more evenly proportioned.
So you would still keep the 0 in that 0 to 4?
Yes, but it wouldn't necessarily symbolize what it often does. So when teachers give zeros, you know, you give an assignment or you have a test and the student doesn't do it and so you give them a zero. The problem with that is twofold. The first is that on a 0 to 100 scale, a zero is just, teachers sometimes call it an atomic zero or an atomic F. It's very difficult for a kid, once they get a zero, to move the zero up past the F range of a 0 to 60. And the second problem is it's inaccurate, which goes back to one of the pillars you mentioned. So it's not that the student knows zero. No student knows zero information. It's that you actually don't know what it is. You don't know what the student knows because they didn't give you anything. So on a 0 to 4 scale, at least if you want to still use a zero, it's not as punishing. Although to your point, I think zeros really shouldn't be used because it's much better to say something like missing. And not even computed into the grade because we don't know what the student knows if they don't tell us.
So incomplete versus F, for example.
That's right. That's right.
So you do believe, Joe, in minimum grading. So, I mean, how do you get results? I mean, would nobody ever get below a 50, for example?
Well, that's right. So the reason why you have minimum grading, which is to have no score lower than a 50, is that you've now made the 0 to 100 scale a proportionate scale. So it's 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, which is... every letter has the same 10 points of distribution. And again, I don't want to get too much into the mathematics, but because minimum grading is so uncomfortable to so many teachers, they don't really want to give a 50% for a student who doesn't do something. The 0 to 4 is a much more palatable way for them to think about it.
And there's something in here called weighted more recent performance that you touched on a bit ago. So you know, if they got at the beginning of the class some lousy grades because they weren't demonstrating mastery of the subject, but more recently they're showing that they know what they're doing, that actually accounts for more?
Well, that's right. So it's another example of where we inadvertently have structural inequities in our grading. So let's say you've got two students, and one, the summer before their ninth grade year, their parents enroll them in a special summer course at the local college where they learn to write a persuasive essay. And so when they come in ninth grade, the teacher starts talking about persuasive essays, and the student from the very get-go writes just a dynamite persuasive essay, and over the 2 months of the persuasive essay unit, they just nonstop write high-quality work. And then you have another student whose parents couldn't afford to put them in that kind of a program, and maybe they had to work over the summer or they had to travel to their grandparents somewhere. And so they come in and they have no idea what a persuasive essay is, and so their first essay is terrible. And then over the 2 months of the unit, they end up writing just as good a persuasive essay as the first student. In our current grading structure, the first student will have an A because I'll have an A average, and the second student will end up having something like a C, even though they've both learned what they need to learn. So we're punishing students who aren't able to have certain opportunities and rewarding students who are. And so if you weight the more recent performance heavier, even to the point of excluding anything earlier than that, you start having a much more accurate grade. It represents what a student knows.
And accuracy, of course, one of the three pillars of equitable grading, along with being bias-resistant and motivational. So what are the components of the bias-resistant pillar?
So bias-resistant is when you wouldn't include things that can be subjectively or would invoke implicit bias. So you wouldn't have participation included. You wouldn't include things like effort or things like extra credit or even things like homework, where the biases that are either structural or implicit in individual people's judgments aren't included in the grade.
So ultimately, then, do we talk about raising the profile of standardized tests? I mean, a lot of people have their issues with standardized tests, but what you're talking about is grading simply on mastery of the subject matter, which is also what standardized tests grade for.
Well, what's interesting is that I am not an unconditional advocate of standardized tests. I think there are a lot of problems with them. But I would want the grade to be more closely correlated with the standardized test score than farther away. And what we're finding in this work is that teachers, when they're using more equitable practices, is that the grades are getting closer to the standardized test. But this really isn't about standardized testing, because it all really rests in the teacher's judgment. If I'm teaching how to write a persuasive essay, only I, as the teacher, can decide what makes for a high-quality persuasive essay. And that would mean that whatever the student's grade is would reflect how well did they do on the persuasive essay. I mean, what's interesting is that in elementary schools, we actually grade in this way. If you can think back to if you have children or if you can think back to your own history, elementary school report card often says a student needed to learn these 8 things in English, and this is how they performed on those 8 things. And that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about not collapsing all this information together.
So again, the three pillars you list of equitable grading: accurate, bias-resistant, and motivational. So on to motivational, you say you want to move to a hope and growth mindset. How would you characterize the system that exists now?
It's really about you get one shot, and if you dig yourself a hole, you can never get out of it. There's no chance of redemption. So the student who started writing a persuasive essay and got an F and a D and another D, oftentimes those students will just say, I guess I'm not a good writer, and it's not worth me trying anymore, and it's going to be too difficult for me to pull my grade out, and they'll just opt out of the course and give up, and they'll start to become a behavior problem. But when you let students know that, you know, it's okay that you didn't do well at the beginning, of course you don't do well at the beginning when you first learn something. It's only through practice. And the student then starts to improve, and it's those grades that get included in the grade. You start to build a lot more motivation for students to do better. Another interesting aspect is around homework. So teachers fear that, well, if I don't give students points for homework, they won't do it, and they have to do homework in order to learn. And what I say back to them is, well, right now they're doing homework because you tell them to. Why don't you have them do homework because it helps them? Help them recognize that when they do homework, they do better on tests. And once students start to recognize, oh, it's actually about me practicing at home because I want to do better on tests, they start to be internally motivated to do homework. Teachers actually find, ironically, that students do homework just as much and sometimes more when they don't give points for them.
And you mentioned already retakes and redos, giving a chance to remove the penalty from mistakes. But then you go on in the motivational section, in the motivational pillar, to talk about practices that lift the veil. What veil are we talking about?
Well, it goes back to rubrics. So many times students have no idea what it takes to get an A, except I just need enough points. But in the teacher's head, they have specific ideas around what does it mean to do well on this certain social science project. And so if we can lift the veil, if we can show students, when I am going to give an A, B, C, D, or F, this is what it takes to get an A, this is what it takes to get a B on this project, it makes the expectations transparent, puts everybody on the same page, and it lifts the veil. It shows us what does it take to be successful in this class. It's not about how many points do you get. It's about what level of mastery can you show, and this is how you show it.
But the students still in their own heads, I mean, if they're used to the old system, they still translate it that into if I do A work, B work, C work, that kind of thing, don't they?
Yeah, they will, but it totally changes the conversation. So when you'll talk to students who are in this kind of a classroom and you ask them, how are they doing and what do they have to do better? In traditional classrooms, they'll say, well, I'm at an 88 and I need two more points to get an A. And I, you know, if I do better on this next test, I'll get an A. In classrooms that use more equitable grading that have these three pillars, they say things like, well, I know how to do the Pythagorean theorem, but I can't apply it using exponents yet, and I'm still trying to figure that out. And once I figure out how to use it with exponents, I'll be able to get an A. And having students talk that way about their learning totally changes the conversation in a classroom and has kids think differently about themselves as learners.
Joe Feldman identifies this as a book for teachers, but obviously there's a lot that all of us who are interested in education can get from the book. It is called Grading for Equity, What It Is, Why It Matters, and How It Can Transform Schools and Classrooms. Joe Feldman, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you. This was great.
A pleasure.